Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019, and you're listening to Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm your co-host, Carrie Klein, and I'm here with Laura Satsui.
Today on our show, we examine gaps in fighting the opioid crisis, starting right here in Kern County. We also talk to the son of a former local civil rights leader in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Later, we continue our reporting on the government shutdown and how it's affecting people here in the San Joaquin Valley. We check in with a volunteer at the Three Rivers Historical Museum. He's heard all sorts of reactions from visitors heading to the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks.
But first, how is the shutdown disrupting court cases? The timeliness of immigration hearings is crucial to whether people can stay in the U.S., but the huge backlog of these cases is growing daily, and that means thousands of lives remain in limbo. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports on the personal toll this backlog is taking in the San Joaquin Valley.
Take this case. A man from El Salvador is married to a U.S. citizen. He was set to get his green card and was supposed to have an important immigration hearing January 3rd. He and his wife were thrilled.
And it didn't happen because the government shut down, or at least partially shut down.
That's his attorney, Camille Cook. She says her client is currently on temporary protected status, but that's about to expire for all Salvadorans in the U.S. in September. She says the judge even went out of his way to schedule the man's case before then.
The clients have absolutely no idea when the case will be reset and if the judge will be able to find time on his calendar again before the end of September of this year.
The man from El Salvador, he's just one of thousands who are stuck waiting.
Having absolutely no idea whether it will be tomorrow or next month is what makes it so difficult, in fact, impossible, to advise my clients about what to do.
The government has been shut down since December 22nd. People with pending immigration cases have no other choice but to take it day by day. And that's tricky, because going to immigration court means taking the day off and traveling all the way to San Francisco.
For those of us in the Valley, where it's, you know, an all-day trip, it would be nice to know with a little bit more notice, but that's not going to happen, apparently.
And you don't want to miss court.
For any immigrant who has a case scheduled with the immigration court, if they don't show up, the judge is obligated by law to deport them.
That's Fresno immigration attorney Nathan Brown.
So, of course, we tell our clients, you know, assume the hearing's going to go forward. Be prepared. Ask for time off work if you need to. Make arrangements. Get your travel all prepared.
But predicting when the longest government shutdown in history is going to end is impossible.
We have to prepare and do the work like the hearing's going to happen. We have to assume the hearing's going forward. So we absolutely do all the briefing, do all the research, prepare everything, mail it out before the deadline.
So far, more than 40,000 immigration cases in the nation have been canceled because of the shutdown. That's according to data from the nonprofit Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse at Syracuse University. Again, Nathan Brown.
That's the crazy irony of all this, is that Mr. Trump ran on immigration and wanting to cut down on this court backlog. This shutdown is just, it's going to make that backlog even worse. And I know that a wall is not going to help with the backlog.
Brown says there was already a backlog before the shutdown. Some immigrants have waited up to 3 years for a hearing.
They're already stressed out of their mind. Many of them have been traumatized by persecution that they've suffered in their home country already. And then to have all this confusion added on top of it really aggravates the trauma they're already going through.
If a hearing gets canceled, the client has no idea when a new one will be set.
It's a huge disruption to the whole system because it once again introduces this sort of unpredictability and a docket shuffling.
That's Ashley Tabador. She's an immigration judge, but can only speak in her capacity as the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. What she means by docket shuffling is judges will have to reschedule their calendars, and the stacks of documents waiting for them are only getting higher.
Judges need to be able to review those files and figure out, well, what are we going to do with them now? Like, you know, do these cases need to be scheduled earlier, later? Is there anything special I need to be mindful of? Was it in the middle of a trial?
Tabador says if a judge decides to prioritize a canceled case and schedule it sooner, then that means another case has to get bumped. So even cases that aren't being canceled during the shutdown might be rescheduled later.
Most likely there's going to be the need for some downtime once the shutdown is over so that people can, you know, just wrap their head around all of these cases that have now been piling up and figure out, you know, what we're going to do. The administrative time that it's going to need in order to review those cases and reset those cases is going to be profound.
Because it's a partial government shutdown, immigration cases in detention centers are still being processed. Meanwhile, some immigrants are benefiting from the shutdown, says Fresno attorney Jeremy Clayson in an email. This includes people in deportation proceedings who don't qualify for any type of legal residency, or people who have weak asylum cases. The longer the shutdown lasts, he says, the longer they get to stay in the U.S. As a side note, the law firm where Clayson practices, the Yara Law Group, is a community sponsor of FM 89. For attorney Camille Cook, she says she's been through government shutdowns before, but not to this extent, with so many cases canceled.
So yes, this is very unique, and this is far worse than we've ever seen before.
Cook says she has several cases that are supposed to go before a judge this week. But whether they'll be heard, well, she's not holding her breath. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
For the first time ever, the National Safety Council estimates that the odds of dying in a car accident are eclipsed by those of dying from an opioid overdose. And although California isn't at the epicenter of the crisis, the San Joaquin Valley has been hit hard. Over the next few months, as FM89's healthcare reporter, I'll be producing a series of stories about the crisis and approaches to solving it throughout the valley, starting in Kern County. It's all part of a data journalism fellowship I've been awarded through the USC Center for Health Journalism. Today, I'm kicking off that series, beginning with a young father who's in recovery. The sun is fading on a Wednesday night, and people are trickling quietly into an office behind an unassuming parking lot in northern Bakersfield. Inside, bright yellow chairs and plastic flamingos lean against turquoise walls. Tom Petty's on the radio, and greeting everyone is a chipper receptionist named Mary Laura.
How's everyone doing?
A scruffy redhead named Larry Bostick leans against the little white check-in counter. He's chatting with Laura through the glass.
She's just giving me full access to my son back now.
She asks him how he's doing, and he smiles underneath his skater cap.
Really good.
Yeah.
I haven't felt this great in like last 2 years.
He tells me he's feeling good because he's clean, off heroin and pills.
Fully on sober, I have been going on 2 months, which, I mean, is good. It's not great, but I feel like I honestly like that this is it for me.
The this he's talking about is a recovery program called Groups, where we are tonight. It's new to Bakersfield, opened last May. People recovering from opioid abuse attend a group session once a week, kind of like Narcotics Anonymous. But here, they don't just get a support system, they also get a prescription for a medication that helps them kick the drugs. Every week, they pee in a cup to show they're taking their meds and nothing else. And it's pretty cheap, $65 a week cash, plus the cost of the medication.
It works for me. You know, other programs may work for other people, but this right here, I know works for me.
About 5.5 years ago, Bostick was hit by a car. He says he was pushed into the back of a public bus. He went through the car's windshield.
I had reconstructive surgery on my face, broken arms, surgery to have teeth pulled out of my hand, broke my leg, my foot, my sternum, a couple ribs.
After such a horrific accident, he was prescribed lots of painkillers, mostly opioids.
The Dilaudid, morphine, all that kind of stuff, you know? Like, I've realized, like, oh, I kind of like this.
His prescriptions ran out. He says he found a way to get more. He couldn't stop even when he was out of money. So he turned to a cheaper alternative, heroin. He says it took a few years for him to realize how deep he'd sunk.
finally hit rock bottom, got my son taken away from me and everything. Knew I needed help.
So he came here to groups. It's a program known as medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. You'll hear me use that acronym a lot. Methadone is one kind of medication used in MAT, but at groups, the drug is buprenorphine. It's kind of like a nicotine patch for quitting smoking. Buprenorphine is an opioid, but it works differently, and doctors taper the dose over time so you can eventually stop.
Well, you don't get high off of it, and it blocks the receptors to, if you do go use on the streets, it just makes you sicker than heck.
Research increasingly shows that MAT programs work better for recovery than trying to quit cold turkey. In Baltimore, a study showed a correlation between buprenorphine and a drop in overdose deaths from heroin. In Kern County, though, MAT is hard to find. Kern has one of the biggest treatment gaps in the state. The Urban Institute estimates nearly 8,000 people in the county suffer from opioid use disorder, and almost three-quarters of them lack access to treatment.
If every single bed and chair was full in this entire county, there would still be a huge amount of people who needed treatment and could not get it.
Ariel Turner is a counselor at Groups. The company mostly operates in the Midwest, but she says Bakersfield fits their target community profile.
Group's mission is to go into rural areas or locations that have a lack of access to treatment. And so Bakersfield is actually the biggest city, town that they've gone into and opened a clinic in.
Turner says treatment gaps here are partly a result of persistent stereotypes and outdated attitudes toward addiction. Many view users as degenerates and criminals and feel that buprenorphine and methadone only enable them to keep using. Javier Moreno used to feel that way too, but now he's a regional manager for Aegis Treatment Centers, the biggest program offering MAT in the state.
Once I saw the medication work, I became a believer and an advocate ever since. I mean, medication-assisted treatment is highly effective. I get to see it every single day.
Another reason patients have a tough time accessing medication is so few providers offer it. For one, they have to either work at clinics like Aegis or get a special waiver from the federal government. But as of a year ago, less than 2% of all prescribers in the county were waivered. Waivers do require extra hours of training, but Moreno also says doctors are overly concerned about how disruptive these patients can be.
I mean, you do have your difficult patient or two, but for the most part, it's very pleasant and rewarding to be able to treat our patients.
Plus, health officials and law enforcement are already stretched thin, taking care of another long-standing drug problem, methamphetamine. But the opioid problem? It's urgent. In the last decade, opioid overdoses have led to more than 1,300 emergency room visits and killed over 560 Kern County residents.
It consumes your whole life. It consumes everything. It just destroys. That's all it does.
For Larry Bostick, recovery has not been a straight shot. Groups is his third attempt. But in the 2 months he's been here, he says he's tangibly changed his life.
My mom talks to me again. My family's back in my life. I got access to my son now. It's been a complete 180, and I can't thank groups, my family and friends, and God, you know? I'm just so thankful that they didn't give up on me.
In today's session, he saw a familiar face, a guy he met through his former heroin dealer. They stick around afterward to chat about the recovery process.
Because you know, you got the drug test results. Keeps you kind of honest.
As they leave, they give each other a big hug. And Bostick tells him they'll get through this together.
So if you ever want to talk about anything or questions or if you feel like you're using something, give me a call.
Yeah, vice versa.
So Carrie, these conversations with Larry Bostick, your main character, they actually happened back in August. How's he doing now?
Yeah, it's been almost 6 months, and in that time, groups counselors confirm he is still in the program, he's still clean, and he's got a new job he's really excited about that takes him traveling all around California. And so that's all really fantastic news. You know, these drugs, they hijack your brain, and kicking them is so, so hard.
Well, that sounds great. It's like a glimmer of hope in a dire situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Carrie, I understand you want to hear even more stories like these.
That's right. This is an ongoing project I'll be reporting over the next few months, and I need help from our listeners. So if you or someone you know has been affected by opioids, if you're involved in providing treatment or counseling or law enforcement and you have a story to share, I would love to hear from you. You can email me at kerry@kvpr.org. That's K-E-R-R-Y @kvpr.org. Or you can call our tip line, 559-862-2714.
All right, but we're not done talking about opioids just yet for the day. Kerry, as you reported, there was also some tragic overdose-related news out of Fresno County last week.
That's right. So last Monday, the Fresno County Sheriff's Office announced a case of a mistaken drug in Fresno. Three men who thought they were snorting cocaine turned out to have been using pure fentanyl, an opioid that's 100 times as potent as morphine and many times stronger than heroin. Two of the men recovered, but one died of the overdose. Aside from the unusual circumstances, however, this is not an isolated incident. Over the past 10 years, opioid overdoses have killed close to 600 people in Fresno County, and 14 of them were from fentanyl. I wanted to know more about responses to the crisis here, so after a press conference about the incident last week, I sat down with County Sheriff Margaret Mims.
What we've done over the years, in 2011, so 7 years ago, we started a Lock It Up campaign. So what we did was start encouraging people to lock up their prescription drugs, or if they weren't using them, to dispose of them, and in fact provided places for them to dispose of them. We were able to get 12 old U.S. mailboxes that we distributed throughout law enforcement in Fresno County. We have one in front of the sheriff's office where people can bring their unused and old prescription to turn them in. So that's been going on for 7 years, and we've collected hundreds and hundreds of pounds of these medications that now aren't available to those who may want to abuse them. The second thing we've done, 5 years ago, we started an awareness campaign because it really truly is all about awareness. Many people in our community don't understand how deep this problem goes. So what we are involved in is it's usually a 5K run that differs year after year, but the whole thing is prescription drug abuse awareness, as well as a turn in your prescription drug program.
And then in 2017, you announced that sheriff's deputies would begin being armed with naloxone, a recovery drug that can help revive people who have overdosed on opioids. So how many deputies at this point are carrying that drug?
It's been distributed to all of our field sergeants who have the ability to go everywhere in the county should the need arise. So,
and how many people is that?
I don't know how many. Yeah, I don't know how many doses that we have distributed so far, but it's significant. We know that 24/7 there is somebody available with Narcan or naloxone that can get it to a location where it needs to be. In addition to the field, though, what I have to think about is our jail population. We may have somebody booked who starts developing symptoms of an overdose. So we have it available in our jails as well.
And what does it mean to be involved with the Central Valley Opioid Safety Coalition?
Well, it feels good to be able to talk about prevention. So many times we find that we're so reactive, because this started on the East Coast several years ago. We knew it was going to work its way west, and it has. And what we've had in the past 2 or 3 years are pockets of overdoses. So we get what we call a bad batch. And that's law enforcement speak for this is very heavy fentanyl-laced drugs. So we just got a bad batch.
So I'm glad you brought up fentanyl, because that, of course, is the reason that we began talking about this earlier this week. The overdose rate is still relatively low. The numbers are quite low, but it's been the number of deaths has been rising very gently since 2011 when we began measuring this. And I was surprised at the press conference on Monday when it seemed like you didn't know whether anyone in Fresno County had died from overdoses due to fentanyl. It seems like something that would be relatively important, relatively basic to know for a law enforcement agency tasked with, you know, reducing these deaths, preventing them. You know, why hasn't fentanyl been more on your office's radar?
Well, for one thing, when the question came is this the very first fentanyl death we had for the year? I didn't know if it was the very first one or not. But what we were able to put together is in the past 2 years, we had 4 deaths each year as a result of overdose, fentanyl overdose. So, and having the coroner's office they're starting to keep track of that. It feels pretty good to know that we don't have the fentanyl death that other areas are experiencing. That tells us, hopefully, we're a little bit ahead of the curve, because we've had the opportunity, frankly, to watch what has happened across our nation. So those kinds of stats are important to keep track of. But I think with the press conference we had the other day, the message was, this is a collaboration. It's not public health only. It's not law enforcement only. It's all of us working together to see what we can do to keep this from getting worse.
And so preventing these deaths, crimes related to them, are clearly priorities for your office. However, you have gone on the record to oppose some of the more progressive measures that have been shown through research to reduce harm, at least. And for instance, like, there was a bill that was introduced in 2017 that would have allowed many counties to establish safe injecting sites for drug users. It didn't end up passing, but you strongly opposed it when it was still making its way through the legislature. You've also spoken out against the needle exchange that is operating here in Fresno, and that's been shown to be reducing disease transmission right here. So how do you square those actions with, you know, everything else that we've been talking about?
Well, the first bill that you discussed was was introduced last year without the knowledge of Fresno County. No legislator came to Fresno County and said, do you want to be part of this bill? And that's just unprofessional and bad business dealings, I think. And in fact, the State Sheriff's Association opposed that bill. And as far as the needle exchange program in Fresno County, I am not going to be involved in enabling people to break the law. That is not what I'm tasked with. My job is to enforce the law, so I cannot, in good conscience, be a part of enabling people to break the law.
Even if it's been shown to reduce other problems like disease transmission or abscesses and, you know, the health of the person using the drugs.
Well, that is in the ballywick of public health. That's what their job is. And I expect them to do their job. In fact, we help each other. But that's what they do. Law enforcement is what I do.
Okay. Well, Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
A couple of weeks ago, the Fresno Police Department put out its end-of-year data on crimes in the city for the last year. And by those statistics, the city saw a number of crimes go down from 2017 to 2018.
Yeah, for example, homicides, shootings, and robberies were all down last year compared to 2017. So if Fresno PD has done such an effective job reducing crime, why was there such a big fight over Measure P? Just a reminder, Measure P was a sales tax on the ballot that would have funded parks, arts, and trails here in Fresno, and it ultimately failed. So Laura, you reported on this measure last year and the fallout right after. Can you add some context here?
Definitely. So the opposition to Measure P really came from a small No on P campaign that included Fresno Mayor Lee Brand and then local law enforcement leaders like Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer and Fire Chief Carrie Donis, also the Fresno Police Officers Association. They were all making the case that we should prioritize law enforcement before parks, or at least simultaneously with parks. And Yes on P, the group that was pushing the measure, tried to address this by saying, well, if the recreational facilities are improved, that will improve the surrounding communities in a number of ways. And then at the last minute, they also tried to add a small public safety piece pertaining to parks. But even still, the measure did not pass.
Okay, so bring us up to speed now. What are we looking at from the Fresno Police Department?
Right. So as we mentioned, the Fresno Police Department sent out some highlights for their 2018 year-end statistics. Compared to 2017, homicides were down 43%, shootings were down about 32%, violent crimes like rape and robbery were down, property crime was down too, calls for assistance were up, but that was the only notable increase among all those other things.
Okay, so that all seems like fairly good news. So considering that Fresno PD had a good year during 2018, why did it advocate so hard for money and ultimately push back so hard against a park sales tax?
Well, we should note that the fight wasn't just opposing this sales tax that singularly supported parks. It's also that Mayor Brand had its own proposal, a sales tax that would have funded both parks and public safety. But he ultimately withdrew it before it even made it to the ballot. And so I think the concern from the No on P campaign was that if a measure for only parks got passed, it would take the wind out of a public safety tax in the future, maybe because residents would feel overtaxed at that point. Or maybe the fear is that a public safety tax wouldn't be as popular unless it was coupled with parks. So, and then additionally, if you look at the city budget year after year, the city does increase funding for law enforcement to some extent. They get a good chunk of the general fund. So when I asked Mayor Brand, okay, why put up such a fight for money, he sent me an emailed statement saying that while crime may have gone down, it's not at what he calls an acceptable level. I'm not really sure what's acceptable except for the impossibility of no crime at all. But Brand pointed out that while the city is growing, the police force is not. So that's one thing money could definitely buy.
Right. So Brand is saying, despite a good year, crime will continue to happen and the police force may not be growing to meet it. So I know that you spoke to the Fresno Police Officers Association about this issue, too. What were their thoughts about these statistics in light of Measure P?
Yeah, I talked to Todd Frazier. He's president of the Fresno Police Officers Association. So he says those statistics may look good, but he thinks there are some caveats. Let's take a listen to what he told me.
We also have a reduction in crime, but the thing is, there is also a corresponding reduction in the laws, all right? Whether some laws were felonies at one time, where we would prosecute, right, or make an arrest and they would be prosecuted, to now they're misdemeanors, right? A lot of times arrests are not made now because they are simply misdemeanors.
Frazier also says that it's not just the classification of crimes, but also whether people decide to report it. So in his words, one shouldn't correlate a decrease in reported crime to the idea that law enforcement is fully funded or that crime is necessarily down overall.
Okay, that can make sense to me that some things might be, might still be happening, just not being reported as much, but that can't be the case with things like murders and shootings, right? I mean, homicides went down by a lot in this past year.
Right, but I guess the way Frazier explained it to me, he kind of jokingly said that the best way to prevent crime is to put an officer on every corner, which they can't do if they're understaffed. And he said even if that were to happen, human behavior is unpredictable. So while crimes like homicide were down in the last year, you know, he's saying they could just as easily rise and be far and away above that in the next year.
You can't hire enough officers to be able to crush crime, so to speak, and make this a crime-free city. But the thing is, we do need to have the personnel to be able to adequately respond in a timely manner to those crimes and those incidents that do occur. And we're not there now.
Okay, so people who were against Measure P still say law enforcement needs a funding boost. That should be the city's priority. So then what's next for that? How might that happen? And could any future effort to do that coexist with a reattempt to fund city parks through a sales tax?
Yeah, so when I reported about this right after the November election, I got the sense that Yes on P folks wanted another try to pass their measure as is, just parks. But Brand recently said in an email to me that he has spoken with key leaders behind Measure P and really wants to compromise on, again, a public safety and parks tax. So I have a feeling that maybe something we'll see in 2020.
Okay, if that happens, we will look for your reporting on it. Thanks, Laura.
You're welcome, Carrie.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
That's the beginning of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. The civil rights activist, whose birthday was celebrated yesterday, actually came to Fresno in the summer of 1964 to lead a march for fair housing conditions for African Americans. And the person who helped bring him here, Maddie Myers, was a tenacious fighter for equal education in the Valley. She died in 2017, but her son, Earl Myers Jr., still lives in Fresno. Our news director, Alice Daniel, spoke with him about his mother's legacy. You may recognize his baritone voice. Myers gives a much-anticipated free annual Christmas concert at the Fresno Westside Seventh-day Adventist Church every December.
Earl, your mother, Maddie Myers, she lived a very long time. She lived to the age of 92, and she achieved so much in her lifetime. She was head of the NAACP in Fresno. What was maybe one of the things she did as head of the NAACP?
When she was president of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, her priority was to bring awareness and a focus to the conditions in West Fresno, the lack of fair education in the school district. I remember her bringing home books from Edison High School. They were old, tattered, outdated. And I remember her, laying those on the dining room table, and just look at this. And it wasn't fair. And what was happening is that when the district was finished with the school books in the other parts of town, in the north part of town, they shipped all of those used, outdated books over to West Fresno.
So tell me, what were some of the steps she took to try to change that?
In the NAACP, under her direction, gave this big banquet. You know, it was an effort to bring people together so that they could see, what the problem was. When she tried to do this, she faced a lot of opposition. They just said, the problem doesn't exist. We don't need to do. She had all sorts of opposition.
And how did she handle the opposition?
My mother was a very fierce fighter. She didn't back down from anyone. I mean, no one. I don't care who it was. I remember being out here in Clovis. She had to speak out here one time, and my dad did not want her to go. She went anyway. I went with her, and I remember walking into the news station just not too far from here, and I remember you could cut the air with a knife, because there was so much hostility when she walked into the room. And she did not back down. She said, this is not fair. This, de facto segregation is not fair. It's being practiced in our schools, and it has got to go.
So she became friends with Martin Luther King, and then she brought him to Fresno to lead a rally around fair housing conditions and de facto segregation. And how did that march go? And also, did you meet Martin Luther King?
I did meet Martin Luther King. And when the march was over, a reception was given for him at a little tiny church on Church Avenue and Holly. I don't recall the name of it, but I think the little church is still there. But that's where I met Martin Luther King. And he didn't stay very long. He came here, he did the march, he spoke. They had the reception, and I remember, he was on his way to the plane that evening.
Did he strike you as someone who had an oversized personality?
I didn't perceive him like that. He was an ordinary looking person, but when he spoke, what came out of his mouth was what was impressive. And my mother was the same way. My mother was just, you know, you just didn't fool her. I mean, we didn't fool around with her at home. When my mother spoke, I mean, you did what she told you to do.
So, Earl, your mother, Maddie Myers, she didn't grow up in Fresno. She grew up in North Carolina. So what was that experience like for her growing up in the 1930s in rural North Carolina?
She was made aware at a very early age the differences between black and white. You know, she was witness to her father, my grandfather, going to work every day, knowing that she might not see him again.
And when you say might not see him again, because of the lynchings that were happening at that time?
Yes, the lynchings, or in the case of any black man, if you looked at a white woman, or you looked at, you know, if they just wanted to shoot you, they would, you know, you could be killed at any time.
I noticed you've got this book out that has pictures and articles about your mother, and one of them says to close Edison High, and that was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Do you think that her efforts made Edison a better high school today?
The fact that Edison High School has the program that it has now, that it is a magnet school, where children from north side of town can come to West Fresno, to get like a more advanced education, are all the result of, you know, the efforts that she put in. I don't think she really wanted to close Edison High School. My mother couldn't close Edison High School the way people thought, you know, she could just go over there and just close it down. But she was trying to bring awareness to the fact that this is not right over here. This is below the standard of education.
Were politicians afraid of her because she had such a great ability to speak, and she was fiery, and she wasn't afraid of other people?
I know that the city officials were. For lack of a better way to say it, I just know you didn't mess with Maddie Myers. You didn't fool around with her. And people who, if you were going to take her on, and there were men who would take, you know, try to take her on, they were no match for her.
So what would you say was her greatest accomplishment?
My mother's greatest accomplishment? I've heard her said that she was always proud of her five children. She was always proud of her five children. Now, my mother and my father, they both sacrificed a lot. Our family life was compromised because my mother was in civil rights. I remember our house being under surveillance by the FBI. The FBI cars were parked across the street. They monitored everything that we did when we went to school, when my dad left to go to his medical practice, whenever my mother, you know, we were followed.
And you're only being watched because your mother cared so much about equal rights for all, and she wanted to make sure that African-American kids got the same kind of education that other kids did. And yet you've got this, the most powerful institution looking through your window.
Right. And it was just very, very scary. I mean, you know, I didn't even know what the meaning of FBI was until, you know, my mother and my dad, but particularly my mother, you know, would sit us down and she would tell us. It wasn't a secret, but I know for me, it was very, very scary because being the oldest, I didn't know what would happen if something happened to my mother and my father. You know, but I was saying this to say that she sacrificed even her family to do what she did. So maybe that would be her greatest accomplishment in serving the people of Fresno.
I'm just wondering, as an African-American man today, do you feel like things have changed that much, or do you feel that this country still has a long way to go?
You know, a lot has been accomplished, but we're not there yet. We're a divided country, and you see now all of the subtleties of racism, they're starting to come back now, and it's because of what people say and how they act. And this arouses in other people those feelings that you thought were gone. You know, the work is, as Martin Luther King said, we still have a long way to go.
Earl Myers, thank you so much for talking with me today. I've learned so much about your mother and the amazing work that she did.
Thank you.
A UC Merced professor spent 18 months examining how religion, mixed with political advocacy, could help the formerly incarcerated reintegrate into society. FM89's Monica Velez spoke with Edward Orozco Flores about the book that came out of his research in L.A. and Chicago. It's called Jesus Saved an Ex-Con.
I did about a year and a half of field work with the Community Renewal Society in Chicago. They had incubated a group called Fighting to Overcome Records and Create Equality. It was led by formerly incarcerated persons. The second part of my field work took place with the Homeboys Local Organizing Committee in Los Angeles, which was under Ali Voice Pico and Homeboy Industries. And I spent another 18 months participating in events and trainings at meetings. I interviewed a total of 34 persons at both sites. So that's what my fieldwork consisted of.
And how do you think getting involved in politics and activism was able to help rehabilitate people who were formerly incarcerated?
That's a great question. In my first book, God's Gangs, which was all about the post-incarceration experience and rehabilitation, I noted that making good from one's past was the central theme. And so making good in the criminology literature is this concept that, you know, folks who have been formerly incarcerated try to pay good deeds forward and help others to prevent others from making the same mistakes that they made. And so I actually got involved with the work in my second book without even realizing how seamless that transition was. I was invited by someone who was a violence prevention worker, and he was doing community organizing, and he had a one-on-one with me. He invited me out to a meeting, and it was many of the same ways in which people try to make good from their past that they were drawing from in order to participate in civic and political action.
And what kind of legislator did they focus on, and were any successful in the past?
Yes, they were very successful. Community Renewal Society in Illinois and Forest successfully advocated for Illinois House Bill 3061 to expand the sealing of criminal records so that the number of crimes in which someone can petition to have the court sealed for the purposes of an employment application background check was increased. They were also successful in passing legislation to remove absolute bars against people with records in employment in healthcare, education, and parks and recreation. With Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, they were very successful in advocating for the passage of a fair chance ordinance, which regulated the use of criminal records background searches to a greater degree than any other city at that time. And they also were part, they also supported the Proposition 47 campaign here in California, which redirected funds from the prison system into rehabilitation programs and community-based organizations.
And what are some of the struggles people went through after they were let out of jail that you noticed? Was there anything that, you know, like a common thread?
Yeah, I would say most folks in my work were trying to redeem themselves. They were trying to redeem themselves in the eyes of those that were closest to them. They were trying to repair relationships, strained relationships with family members. And so most of their work centered on making good from their past, but as well being able to redeem themselves in the eyes of those folks that were closest to them.
And in the year and a half that you were in the field, did you see changes in the people that you followed and that you talked to?
That's a good question. My work, in my interviews, folks talked about change incessantly. And so, I mean, it was something that was constantly being discussed. And in the settings that I was in, where folks were engaging in civic and political action, there were numerous instances in which I saw that these settings lent themselves to the process of being able to experience personal reform. And so in my book, both in my first and my second book, I described this as a performance. In the language of sociology, practices in which they engaged in were performances that helped to redeem themselves in the eyes of others.
How long have the faith-based organizations that you mentioned in their book, how long have they been doing this?
They've actually been doing this for quite a while. So faith-based community organizing is a civic religious tradition that emerges from American community organizing. Sal Alinsky, who is known as the founder of American community organizing, which is a set of practices that enable democratic participation in American civil society, that tradition reaches back to the 1930s and 1940s. But in my book, I also describe how Sal Alinsky's work was picked up by religious and faith leaders following the civil rights movement. The founding of the four major national networks of community organizing, PICO, which is now called Faith in Action, as well as DART, the Gamaliel Foundation, and the Industrial Areas Foundation. All of these organizations grew tremendously following the civil rights movement, and the founders and the executive directors can trace you can trace the genealogy of the evolution of these organizations back to Sal Alinsky and the folks that were his disciples.
So this kind of thing has been happening for a while then.
Mm-hmm.
And have you found other organizations that are kind of following this model or trying to do the same thing?
Yeah, I do. And I think the short answer is it requires a certain amount of capacity to be able to do this work.
Sure.
A certain amount of funding, a certain amount of commitment, a certain number of people that you can get in a room. Churches really lend themselves to community organizing. And the history of religion in America is one in which religion has been embedded in social movements. So I think, you know, you see the sorts of things that I witnessed in Chicago and Los Angeles. If you look closely, you notice it in a lot of other communities. But I think maybe the difference is the scope and the scale of what PICO, Alley Voice, and CRS Force were doing in my book. They had the resources to participate in a greater number of campaigns and to be successful in them and to have to be able to affect such important policy change, whereas other groups that are a little smaller don't have the same capacity.
And what do you think is the most eye-opening thing that you found while you were, you know, in these cities talking to all these people over the 18 months?
I would say the most eye-opening thing to me was how personal the meaning of political activism was. Folks didn't talk about it as political activism. They really did talk about it as giving back to their community, which I conceptualized as making good. But it was something that was deeply personal. And so in these settings, as organizers, we're teaching them the practices of community organizing, right? How to have meetings, how to have one-on-ones, how to have a one-day training, you know, debriefing from all of these exercises and, you know, evaluating them. So all of the things that are part and parcel of community organizing that were communicated by organizers to formerly incarcerated people were really embraced as ways of being able to engage with others in a pro-social way. And so it was that deep personal meaning of being able to connect with others that I understood in my first book, but watching it even as it developed in the public sphere, right, around legislative change or changing city ordinances in my second book, that really helped me to understand the profound significance of making good.
And did you find that a lot of, you know, the people you talked to who were formerly incarcerated, did they really want to do this work? Like, was it something that they, like, how did a lot of them, like, get into this in the first place?
I would say for some of the folks that were involved in faith-based community organizing, that some of them were drawn in because of their religious beliefs. I remember there was one person in the book, Marlon Chamberlain, who was the leader of FORCE after its founding, and he led a group, a spiritual group. It was like a Bible studies group called God or Nothing. And he said, you know, once a week they would meet, and you know, they would really test each other and ask each other if they were, you know, if they were living, you know, living in a faithful way. And so it was, I think that was one important way that people became involved, was because it resonated with their religious beliefs and religious practices.
And do you think this model will be able to help rehabilitate the thousands of other people who were formerly incarcerated around the country?
I think that you can never have enough democratic participation. And so, yes, there's, you know, even though there's organizations that are doing this work, there's still more of it that can be done in many places, in many ways. And the beauty of this is that at the core of community organizing is our one-on-one relationship, one-on-one meetings, developing personal relationships, building trust, you know, developing leadership skills among people that have, you know, talent, that have abilities, and just haven't been given the opportunity to put those abilities to use. So it's something that I would say can grow exponentially.
Again, we are in the studio with Edward Flores, who was a sociology professor at UC Merced and the author of Jesus Saved an Ex-Con, Political Activism and Redemption After Incarceration. Thanks so much again for coming, Edward.
Thank you.
And before we go, we checked in with Tom Marshall, a volunteer with the Three Rivers Historical Museum and Visitors Center. The museum is on the way to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. During the government shutdown, the parks have been open with limited services, then closed, and then open again. Our news director, Alice Daniel, spoke with him about the various reactions he's seen from sometimes confused visitors.
I know that the park has opened back up, but yes. What kinds of comments have you received in the past couple of weeks?
The people, especially international visitors, from a couple of them from South America, a couple from Europe, kind of got the impression that the reason why the government wasn't working is because it was a strike by the public.
That's very funny. What did you say to that?
And I explained to him. I said, "No, it's not. It's something that it's a budget thing that goes between our Congress and our president, and they're just trying to arrive at a budget for us. So I didn't want to put any real strong negative things on it for them. They pretty much understood. In fact, it was generally speaking, the international visitors, while they were definitely upset that it wasn't open, they accepted that easier than people in California.
And did you get some entertaining or funny or curious comments that you can remember?
More comments from people in the immediate valley that didn't quite understand why they were closed when I would explain that it's a government shutdown. Partial shutdown. They hadn't heard about it. They didn't know anything about it. I said, "Well, have you looked at the news or anything like that?" "Oh, yeah, we look at that all the time. And I guess they missed it or something."
That's a pretty big story to miss.
Yeah, it is a very big story to miss. Generally, I was, based on the people that were making those comments, it was probably somebody in the family that was asking the question and not necessarily everybody in the family.
Right, right. And you said that you started to see more numbers, more people coming in once they realized that the park, or I guess at the point when it was still open, but they weren't charging. Were you seeing more people?
Once the news got down in the valley or in California that there was no admission fee, they were just coming up in groves, just a solid stream of cars. And that's really what shut down Sequoia altogether for a period of time, there were so many cars, it would turn to gridlock, and they had to sort out the cars. And then on top of that, if you did go up, you had to have chains on your vehicles.
It was a little chaotic then.
I mean, it was amazing to watch the amount of traffic going by the museum here, because we're right on 198, about 3 miles, 3.5 miles from the entrance.
And so what does it look like this week?
A lot slower. A lot slower. I think that a lot of people that did come up and get caught in the gridlock because from the entrance to Giant Forest, it would take normally an hour. It was taking 3 and 4 hours when it went to gridlock.
Oh, my goodness.
And then people in the middle of the road putting chains on. And then the number of people that, again, it's the minority number of people that abused what was up there.
Right, of course. But you're not seeing the same numbers that you saw.
No. Uh-uh.
And why
Even
do you
know it's free to get in at the moment?
Oh, why do you think that is?
The number of people, and the hard part was that when it was open and free, and they had gridlock, it was also right after Christmas, and so there were a lot of families on Christmas vacation.
So yeah. Now people are back at school, and
yep.
Traffic has slowed down.
Yes.
It's not chaotic anymore.
That's right.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at kvpr.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Laura Satsui, reporter Monica Velez, and news director Alice Daniel. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.